This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. This is The Money. Australia is an increasingly imprisoned country. Our imprisonment rate is the highest it's been in a century. The best estimates say we have more than 40,000 people inside, and this is costing a fortune. So how much could we save if we let some of them out? We'll come back to that later on.
Even at a global summit to save the planet, money makes the world go around. Leaders have left, and now it's up to negotiators to figure out who pays for what.
Countries are setting the tone on ambition, and now, of course, the finance needs to follow. Behind
closed doors. In the lead-up to Glasgow, the money's been looking at different aspects of climate change. This week, we wanted to focus on progress that's been made. And a conference, the Impact X Summit, has been looking at ways of speeding up the transition to net zero. One of the speakers, Fiona Davis, heads the Farmers for Climate Action. 15% of Australia's emissions come from agriculture. The biggest chunk is methane from livestock.
So there are a number of strategies. I saw some of them firsthand when I visited one of our beef farmers earlier this year. John Wright has been working on this problem for a couple of decades, and he's been breeding low emission stock. So he's got a brilliant setup with the University of Sydney at his place, where he actually tracks the cattle and their emissions. So he selects for low emission stock, and gradually he's being able to breed low emissions animals, which he can then sell as part of his beef business. So there's breeding, there's the diet, and so that's feed supplements and forages that can actually reduce methane emissions from stock. Scientists are working on a methane vaccine, which will make a big contribution to what we can do in terms of reducing emissions. We're also looking at, particularly this works very well in the pig industry, of capturing methane emissions, so biogas capture. And you can either burn these emissions to destroy them, or you can actually use them as a source of energy. So there's a lot of potential there.
It's not just methane that needs to be sorted out.
We commissioned Ernst & Young to draft a report on opportunities for agriculture in a low emissions future earlier this year. And they've come back with a strategy or a pathway that sees agriculture reach the equivalent of net zero emissions by about 2040. It's not the most ambitious pathway. It's a very practical pathway, but, you know, it involved a lot of ag stakeholder engagement to make sure that this was really practical and was reflective of what could be taken up on farm. And one of the biggest solutions there is just improved land management, and that accounts for about 43% of the pathway. So, you know, how you manage your grasslands and pastures, so increasing soil carbon and land productivity in these natural grassland improved pastures through sustainable management practices. So these are strategies that farmers can use within their farm business that will actually increase their productivity on farm. But there's the opportunity to be actually paid by the government and other stakeholders to draw down that carbon through these practices. So it's an opportunity for farming families to really diversify their income.
That income would add to the $67 billion that agriculture makes every year. And part of the new money would come from changing how some of the land is used.
So land use change is also part of the solution that EY put forward as part of their pathway. So this is reforestation of marginal land. So it's important to note we're looking at a model that takes in 0.9% of total farmland. That's a very achievable percentage, I'd say. So it involves planting on less productive land. So what you have as part of your farming system, most farms, you're going to have portions of your property that aren't as productive, that we could call marginal land. And we can reforest these. So they act actually as carbon sinks on there. They improve the quality of your land and water supply, and they provide biodiversity outcomes and also shelter for livestock. And as well as the reforestation of this marginal land, integrated shelter belts. You know, farmers have been doing this for a long time. We just need to scale it up. This was a feature of the dairy farm I grew up on. We had shelter belts, you know, right across the fence lines on our property. And it was so important for shelter for stock. And it provides this important environmental benefit as well. So that's modelled at 0.4% of total farmland, these shelter belts. So we've got to think about really carbon plantings within productive farming systems.
So how much is carbon going to be worth for farmers?
We're looking at around 34.4 through to 43 billion by 2040 for carbon as an income stream for Australian farmers. And that's assuming that carbon's worth about $40 to $50 a tonne. That's more than it is today, but it's certainly the direction it's heading in. And the report authors felt like this was a, you know, a safe figure to base that on. And the other thing to remember is farm income has a flow-on effect for Australian regional communities. So it creates jobs in communities. And the report authors estimated that there'd be 25 to 50 jobs per million tonnes of carbon dioxide equivalent abated. So it's fabulous for the farm business. It's great for their communities. And it also contributes to our environmental commitments as a nation.
Construction can make a contribution too, at least on the lowering emissions side. Dayo Prasad from the University of New South Wales says at the moment the sector is a significant emitter.
There are many numbers floated around, but the latest numbers globally, for example, are those that are presented today in Glasgow by the Global Alliance for Building and Construction, which is a UN body. And around 37% of emissions are attributed to buildings and construction. And within that, we have about 10%, which is the construction industry, the selection of materials, embedded carbon, and so forth. And about 27, 28% in that order is much more the operational carbon. So the total is 37% in Australia. It's slightly higher. 40% is quoted as a rounded off number. And that sort of corresponds to about 90 megatons of carbon from the construction industry. And half of this is actually from heavy infrastructure and construction and rest from buildings and roadways and so forth.
Right.
So it is quite significant.
It really is. Dayo mentions operational emissions. They're what you get from powering heating, cooling and lighting. Better design, on-site solar and renewable energy can get them down to net zero. But what about the building materials themselves?
So some of it is already underway. For example, for concrete, instead of Portland cement, they're beginning to use geopolymer products. Geopolymer, the input source is fly ash and slag from burning of coal at power production plants where they use coal still. In other words, the input is something that was going to be dumped away anyway, and they're paying good money to transport it and dump it somewhere. And they're using that to produce geopolymer, which has about one third or so of the embodied carbon compared to cement. And there are buildings being built. So you can now get away with using much lower carbon in cement. On the side of steel and aluminium, there is a lot happening, the green steel, as they call it. It's a matter of what the input energy system is. If it comes from renewables, you are okay. But most of the input energy is from lower carbon sources. For example, recycled tires, things like that have gone into the furnace, which has a lower carbon intensity. And as a result, you can get products. But you can also use recycled products, recycled steel, etc., which are less than half the embodied carbon as well and of equal durability and strength.
You've been in this area quite a long time, some decades. How optimistic are you that we're going in that direction?
We have been optimistic before, but things haven't changed. I remember being in the photovoltaics field maybe a couple of decades ago at the university, and we were thinking it makes so much sense. People should be using it in within 5 years. So 5 years later, we kept saying another 5 years. But I think the time has come. The imperative about climate change, and people are actually experiencing the effects. And when you're listening to the news on an hourly basis from Glasgow this week, you can see how countries are coming together. We should invest in huge research opportunity and huge capacity building to underpin this change towards energy efficient and low carbon to zero carbon buildings. I think we are at the cusp of a major change. And by 2030, I am pretty confident that we can do it. I've been working with the Institute of Architects, which has a large group responsible for designing most of the buildings in the country. They started a climate action group within the Institute, and they really want to drive for 2030 and not have people designing buildings that are not net zero past 2030. So with pressures like that and groups like that involved, I think there is time to change.
For Jane Hunter, the big change is already happening. She's the CEO of Tritium.
Tritium is a global company headquartered in Australia, and we develop and manufacture direct current or DC fast chargers for electric vehicles. So we make what's called a level 3 charger, which is a rapid DC charger. And that's a charger that can top your vehicle up in a short period of time, similar to the petrol station model that's currently used for internal combustion engine vehicles.
Right. I was reading actually the other week about a bus depot in Logan, which of course is southwest Brisbane, that you've been working in. What have you done there?
Yeah, we've just installed 10 fast chargers on site there in Logan, and we do think that's the largest number of universal fast chargers on one site in Australia. So universal fast chargers are ones where any electric vehicle can charge at the charger, as opposed to a proprietary fast charger, like, for example, Tesla chargers, which can only be used by Teslas. And that particular depot, which is Clark's Logan City Bus Service, decided to transition some of their fleet to zero emission buses. And we're very pleased to be providing fast chargers to fuel those buses, which helps them enable zero tailpipe emissions from the buses, as well as reduced noise pollution.
Buses aren't actually the main game for Tritium. The market they're after is private cars.
If you think of petrol, so it was previously sold for vehicles as something of a closed shop because of the fact petrol's an environmental hazard, it's highly flammable. So the sites were very restricted and highly regulated in terms of petrol storage. And the sale of petrol was either through fuel retailers like BP and Shell and Caltex, or via some of the large supermarkets who just started to make inroads into fuel. But EV chargers are quite different in the way that they fuel a vehicle, in the sense that they can be installed anywhere. And the fast chargers that we make, including these relatively rapid public chargers, can be installed directly onto streets, even in residential areas, so that you're no longer limited to the fuel forecourts as you used to be. And what that's meant is that the customer channels are currently being very heavily fought over, with a lot of new entrants into the market to distribute energy to cars. And if you think of those key channels as the fuel retailers who are having their Kodak moment and thinking about how they go and replace the sale of fuel with kilowatts per hour sale, the electricity utilities, because they're increasing the drawdown on the grid and they're also gathering up an additional customer base where when you pay your bill at home, you'll pay both your car and your home electricity bill on the same invoice. And then you've got retailers, so shops like Golf World and Dan Murphy's, Woolworths, as well as the car manufacturers, so the EV manufacturers themselves are a channel, as well as fleet operators. So it's a very diverse base of customers now. Buses, trucks, most definitely part of that, but they're, you know, a part, not the main part.
Jane says Tritium can't keep up with demand. Both sales and backlog are growing. The company expects to list on the tech-heavy NASDAQ exchange in the next few months. Prospects are good.
Look, it's a very rapidly expanding market. And yeah, the way that we've seen, and these numbers best at the moment are illustrated by Bloomberg New Energy Finance. They've really got a finger to the pulse of the market. In 2020, if we had a look at that market, it was about 78,000 DC chargers were projected. That's without China. With China, it's 383,000. And then they're showing that market growing out to 2040 to the need for 5 million DC chargers. And that excludes China. So China adds another 2.8 million on top of that.
What would you like from the government that you don't have now?
Really, all that's required from governments, both at the state and federal level in Australia, to drive this uptake is simply an indication of support for the technology, the fact that it's coming, and to prevent the dissemination of counterfacts to that which aren't actually true. So it just needs to be policy-based. It doesn't have to be subsidies. So subsidies obviously drive a more rapid uptake, but they're not required. What's required are favourable government policies and actually just information from government as opposed to disinformation. And the other issue that I've seen occur in Australia, which we haven't really seen so much globally, is that government here has talked a lot about hydrogen as a competing technology, whereas it really isn't for passenger vehicles anymore. I believe the stats are now that there's, you know, 100 EV models per one hydrogen model globally. So that's really all that's needed from government. It doesn't have to be subsidies, but favourable policies and clear communication.
Jane Hunter from Tritium. And this is The Money on Radio National, the ABC Listen app, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Ady. When the subject of prison reform comes up, it tends to be dominated by politicians, shock jocks, tabloid newspapers. You tend not to hear from economists. But that hasn't stopped the Productivity Commission from having a look at it, with a report titled Australia's Prison Dilemma by Commissioner Stephen King. Stephen, how much do we imprison people here?
A lot. By world standards, our imprisonment rate is fairly high. It's above the OECD numbers. But the most disturbing statistic is the rate of increase in imprisonment. So over the 15 years to 2018, our imprisonment rate went up by 39%. Now, that was third highest in the OECD, only beaten by Turkey and Colombia, and well out of line with countries that we usually compare ourselves with. UK and Canada, for example, over the same period, the rate of increase was 1%.
And actually, make this pretty clear in the report. Of course, what you're really dealing with here is eight completely separate jurisdictions. And in some of those, of course, it went up a lot more than that.
Oh, indeed. But the trend over Australia as a whole was an increasing level of imprisonment. So, yep, at the top of the league table in terms of growth, we've got the Northern Territory, which actually grew over the 20 years to 2020. Its imprisonment rate grew by 87%. Down the bottom of the league table, New South Wales, it only grew by a bit under 15. But a big spread across Australia, but all seeing that same trend.
I'll come on shortly to why this is happening, but you're the Productivity Commission, so it's about economics. How much do we spend on it?
Total cost of our prisons is about $5.2 billion per year. That's around about $120,000 per year for each prisoner. It does differ between the states and territories. It depends on the number of staff in the prison, the type of programs. But that $120,000 a year per prisoner numbers, a pretty good ballpark figure.
And, of course, that doesn't obviously address other costs, like for the families of the prisoners, the opportunity costs of the prisoners themselves of being inside and not being able to do anything more productive.
Yeah, there's a big opportunity cost, obviously, of being in prison. If you've got a job and you go to prison, you obviously lose your job and your employment prospects when you come out are off pretty low. If you have a family, you often lose the family whilst you are in prison. There's intergenerational effects. Having a parent in prison impacts the kids usually pretty badly. So what is really concerning to the Productivity Commission is that group of people, often who are in there for minor crimes. So we're talking about possibly a drug possession, not drug trafficking, but drug possession, a minor theft, minor property damage, public order offences, those sort of offences where you've got people who aren't a great risk to the community, but they're in prison, they've been in prison multiple times, and they're cycling in and out of prison. So they're on this sort of treadmill where they're in prison, they get released, often they're released without any support, often they have untreated alcohol and drug issues, untreated mental health issues, they may have ongoing cognitive impairment, sometimes they're homeless. So for example, 5% of people going into prison are homeless, they're sleeping rough or they're couch surfing. And then obviously we release them from prison. If we don't give them any support, they're just back on the streets again. It's just not benefiting anyone because it's very expensive to the taxpayers. It's not benefiting those individuals themselves. They are just on this unfortunate treadmill.
Now, you've already spelt out how much our imprisonment rate has been going up. How well, though, does this reflect the crime rate?
the crime rate has in fact been going down. So this was our starting point when the Productivity Commission started looking at the justice system. But the odd fact that stood out to us was that around the last decade, the imprisonment rate's gone up by about 25%. The offender rate has gone down by about 18%. And that's not a new trend. It's been going on since about the mid-1980s. And as I said, the growth of imprisonment that we've had in Australia is out of line with other developed countries. So it's not the sort of thing where we say, oh, well, this is some sort of trend we've seen around the world. No, Australia's a standout in this respect of higher numbers in prison but lower crime rates. And it's really that to ask why. Mm. Why is this occurring?
On the face of it, it doesn't make sense. What is driving it, Stephen?
A lot of it is driven by tough-on-crime policies. Now, these policies differ across Australia, and the overall picture is complex. So I don't want to give the impression to the listeners that, you know, it's a simple solution. But the common driver across every jurisdiction that we've found is tough-on-crime policies. The sort of policies where we make it harder for people to get bail. Unsurprisingly, when you have that, you have a big increase in the number of people on remand. So these are individuals in prison, but they're awaiting trial or awaiting sentencing. And that actually accounts for 64% of that growth in prison numbers over the last decade. So tough on bail laws, tough on parole laws, where we say, no, you've got to serve your full sentence. A consequence of that, by the way, is that if you're released on parole, you at least have some minimal supervision to try and help you reintegrate into society. If you do your entire prison term, you're often shown where the bus stop is, and that's the only support that you get. So that's also led to more people in prison, but actually an indirect consequence is often less support when people leave prison. Mandatory minimum sentences, where we've said, well, that crime now requires the individual to go to jail. That removes the discretion from magistrates, from the judiciary, so that they can't make the nuanced decisions where they say, yes, this person really belongs in jail versus another offender who may be better given a bit more of a second chance or an alternative in the community. So tough-on-crime policies have really underpinned this big increase in prison numbers.
When one looks at the prison population, though, there are some people who certainly should be in there. I mean, there are some people in prison who are, who have committed the worst offences and are extremely dangerous. And a big part of why they're in there is to protect everybody else from them. What sort of percentage is in there for violent offences?
When we look at the prison population, around 58% of people are in there for violent offences. And certainly the community expects and deserves to be kept safe. But at the same time, at the other end of the spectrum, we have around 35% of people in prison who are sentenced for less than 6 months, sometimes less than 3 months. And it's these individuals who are generally in there for minor offences, often repeat minor offences. They provide little risk to community, but they're the ones who are on this prison treadmill of release, minor crime, back into prison. It's really that group that we need to think about the alternatives. And savings from being able to have alternatives for that group are pretty substantial. Mm,
okay, well, let's talk briefly about the alternatives and then we'll talk about the savings. If these, I suppose, lower risk, non-violent offenders don't go to prison, what do we do instead?
Yeah, there's a range of options that have been tried around the world. But I do want to caveat the discussion by saying one of the things that the Productivity Commission found was that while lots of things are being tried, both here in Australia and around the world, very few are being properly evaluated. So there is a lack of data in this area. There's a lack of knowledge about what works. But we were able to find some, and we've highlighted them in our report. A good example is the South Australian program of home detention. So individuals who are low risk to community, rather than being sent to prison, are released with home detention with electronic monitoring under supervision, and that can often be tied into programs that are compulsory for the offenders but aim to get them off the treadmill. So, for example, they may be alcohol and drug rehabilitation programs, or if there's an undiagnosed issue of mental illness, then it may be engagement with the health system. That has benefit for the offenders, and we see that in the recidivism rates. We actually see people getting off that treadmill. Not huge numbers, but enough to make it worthwhile. But the big savings actually for the taxpayer, the sort of program that they have in South Australia, you're looking at a reduction of around 80 to 90% in the cost compared to prison.
Right. That's very substantial. How much money could we be saving? I mean, if all that 35-40% around that number were diverted to a combination of home detention and electronic monitoring and rehabilitation, which of course have their own costs, but they weren't in prison, which, as you've explained, is very, very expensive. It's hundreds of dollars a day per person. How much money could we save?
So first off, rather than focusing on all the 35%, let's bring it right down. Let's just say we looked at the 1% who were least risk to community Australia-wide and used alternatives such as home detention under supervision for that group. That's a saving of around $45 million per year. So even if we just took that small cohort of low-risk individuals, that's about $45 million a year. But it builds up significantly over time. So, for example, if we had actually kept imprisonment rates constant for the last 20 years, rather than following this sort of tough-on-crime approach, then we would have saved around $13.5 billion over that period of time. So these savings become really very significant over time.
That's real money, even in these sort of pandemic times when we've got used to the government spending vast amounts of money. $13.5 billion is real money.
Yeah, well, to give a comparison, I was involved in the mental health inquiry for the Productivity Commission. Our recommendations there, if they'd all been accepted by the government, would have come to about $4 billion per year. So $35 billion goes a long way to funding, in that case, a significant mental health reform for, you know, getting up towards 10 years.
Do you think that your report will be read and even implemented by any of these jurisdictions, or are you just trying to start a kind of national conversation? What's the aim?
We did find from our discussions with numerous parties that we are a bit of an oddity because we're a group of economists and we're really focusing on this primarily from the perspective of, well, is the taxpayer getting value from money out of our prison system? And our conclusion is, no, we can do better. That's very different to the usual criminal justice discussions around the social causes of crime or the, you know, the overrepresentation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in prison. So hopefully by bringing a different perspective, we're able to really ignite this national discussion. And it's bringing those costs into the debate to understand, well, we can actually do better. We want to make sure we don't put the community at risk, but we can do better than our current system.
Stephen King, thank you very much for joining me today on The Money.
No, thank you very much, Richard.
Stephen King is a commissioner with the Productivity Commission. And that's the show for this week. The Money is produced by Belinda Summer. Our sound engineer is Simon Branthwaite. I'm Richard Adie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.